Maybe for tonight, what I'd like to do is start a little bit with the words of Rumi. We came to this earth to do one thing, and that even if we succeed at 100 other tasks, if this one thing is neglected, our life will be wasted. And if this one thing is fulfilled, that whatever else happens, our life will be fulfilled. Some languages call this one thing love. All our therapies and all our scientific advances will disappoint us if love is missing. And when love is present, the whole world turns into the temple. So we come to this world for one thing. And it's really one of the great questions if you're at the end of your life and you're looking back, is just that question, have I loved well? And we all know it intuitively, that if we're sensing our whole incarnation, that that's really the basic inquiry. That's kind of what matters in this world of form. So I was teaching last weekend at Kripalu up in Massachusetts, and teaching about acceptance and understanding and love. And there is a repeating inquiry during the weekend, which was really, how do we love with an open heart and yet have appropriate boundaries when somebody is acting in a way that's harmful? Or how to love when the love is filled with attachment, you know, when a woman was asking dependency on her boyfriend. Or how to have compassion, this real care about the world, asked one who is a political activist, without feeling absolutely overwhelmed, you know. And then the other questions were, what do you do when your heart's cut off and you just feel like compassion's an abstract idea, you know? So these are really questions about the shadow side of love. And love when it's kind of mixed with grasping and with fear. And the truth is that most moments our loving is marbled like that. It's okay. I mean, it's just that we're in a body and we're caught up with some of our selfing, you know, preoccupation with self. And our love has got those currents of grasping and fear. So in the Buddhist tradition, all the teachings on awakening the heart, all the teachings on loving kindness and compassion are taught hand in hand with the wisdom teachings of equanimity. Hand in hand. And the word for bodhicitta is the awakened heart mind. In some Asian scripts, it's the same word. That any awakening of this heart, for it to be mature. Now, there's a lot of loving. It's just not that mature. And that's not to judge it. It's just to say that there's an invitation to keep becoming more awake and clear and pure. And what purifies our love is this wisdom of equanimity. So what I'd like to do tonight is explore what are called the three characteristics, or the three insights about how life is, that when we get it cellularly, when it's really awake in us, it guides us to love in a very mature way. The three characteristics. And just to say that it's described that love, when it's not mature, it's just kind of contracted by ignorance. And even the word ignorance is kind of a severe word. It means ignoring the big picture. That we're forgetting something. We're loving, but we're forgetting something. You know, we're forgetting our wholeness. And we're forgetting the pain that happens when we try to hold on. So when we're awake to how it all is, when we're not in trance, we experience what's called the pure heart's release, which is that total freedom to love without holding back. And those of you that come a lot know that phrase, love without holding back, can have some real power when we sense that one of the biggest sufferings in our life is to feel how much love is here and sense how rarely we just let it flower and let it be felt in this world. We hold back. So let me go over the three characteristics. I'll just name them, and then we'll take each one and explore how does this help to wake up these hearts, guide these hearts to love in a very wise way. The first of the characteristics is the truth of suffering, that whenever we are holding on, resisting, trying to control our moment, ourself, another, there's suffering. That's the first characteristic. These are in the noble truths. It's the first and second noble truth, for those of you familiar. So the first characteristic, suffering. Whenever we're controlling, there's suffering. The second characteristic, and these are the characteristics of existence that if we're awake to, wake us up. The second characteristic is impermanence. So the first one's called dukkha. The second one is anicca, impermanence, which says everything's changing. These forms are temporary. Everything we want to hold on to, it just is not going to last. The third characteristic is called anatta, which means no self, which means that we might have a story running all the time about who's here, but when we really look deeply, we're empty of the solid selfness we think is there. Now, if that one rattles us some, we don't have to directly go at it, because by really waking up to the nature of suffering and impermanence, we begin to see more fully that we're not who we thought we were. Okay, so the first, let's just start with, how can understanding suffering help us to love more wisely? I'll apply it to relational suffering. That we suffer relationally when we get into a reactive dance, and it's never one person. If there's suffering, there's some involvement with two. And it's in some way we're ignoring the truth of connection, and we've locked into identities where one person thinks of themselves. Often there's the pursuer and the resister. You know, and somebody's wanting more and somebody else is avoiding. Or there's other dynamics like the blamer and the defender, or the controller and the one that's kind of protecting. And we know what happens, that if one person, like let's say a parent, is trying to control a child, we know that built into that dynamic is the need to resist that controlling. And that that there's a kind of hostility. The child lies maybe or avoids, and then the parent becomes more controlling, and then it spirals more and more. That's the dukkha of the relational dance. Or with partners, one might want more of an expression of affection, and then the other feels manipulated and withholds, and the other one wants more, and then they withhold more. But you see what I'm saying, that it becomes its own entity of dukkha, this trying to control and then the reaction to it. Anytime we have an agenda in a relationship to want more, to want things a certain way, to want the person to change, to want something for ourselves, any agenda, even the ones that seem most benevolent in some way, create distance. Here we go again. A young man once asked God how long a million years was to him. God replied, "A million years to me is just like a single second in your time." Then the young man asked God what $1 million was to him. God replied, $1 million to me is just like a single penny to you." Then the young man got up his courage and asked God, "Could I have one of your pennies?" God smiled and replied, "Certainly, just a second." So So whether it's with our partner or child or with God, any sense of bargaining or wanting creates the distance. And we know what it's like when someone's affections are mixed with wanting something from us. We get a little bit suspicious or a little bit defended or protective. And what about when someone's affections are mixed with, I want you different? We know what that's like. So let's look at how this first wisdom of the suffering that comes when there's any controlling, how this can wake us up in our relationships. And as I often do, I'm going to invite you to choose a relationship tonight where you'd just like to bring more wisdom to your loving, more have more freedom there. So the first characteristic says understanding suffering, and yet understanding has levels. And you might think to yourself, well, yeah, I know that when I'm critical, then there's a reaction from my partner that they withdraw or evade or get defensive. So that's one level of understanding. The Buddha's invitation is to drop down into a much deeper level of presence in terms of understanding the suffering. And the understanding is that I find there's two different questions we can begin to ask that really reveal what's going on. And one is when we're in one of these dynamics that I call the relational dukkha, the relationship suffering, is to discover our intention. And what is my intention right now when I'm in this? And the other is to intuit the outcome of what we're doing. Oh, when I act like this, what's the outcome? But we'll go back to this. I'm going to walk you through it. The basic understanding is that if we don't bring full presence at the times that we're in the reactivity, if we don't bring full presence and discover the vulnerability that's there, we are doomed to rerun the pattern over and over. Some of us wonder why we're doing the same thing we were doing when we were 14 in relationships. It's very simple. We have not brought full presence to the vulnerability that lies under the pattern. Full presence to the dukkha, the suffering. And that condemns us. We have to keep repeating it. Some of you remember a story I once told about two men who were talking after a workout in the gym, and one was confessing that it had been a really embarrassing day, that during somewhere in the middle of the day he had been speaking with a woman in the office that he was very attracted to, and he made some faux pas. Something he said ended up having a sexual innuendo that really he hadn't meant it, but that's the way it came out. And his friend said, oh, it happens all the time. It's called a Freudian slip. Why, just the other morning I was having breakfast with my wife and I meant to say, please pass the sugar, but instead I said, you damn bitch, you ruined my life. I'm sharing that one because it's so obvious. You know, we know it, that when we don't bring the presence, when we don't bring the attention to what's really going on, it just keeps playing itself out. If we don't say what needs to be said, then we get in trouble. And if we say it in a way where we're not clear on our intentions, we get in trouble. So, here's the challenge. We have run through our pattern of reactivity millions of times. Our unwise ways of loving, millions of times, where we're in a trance. And there's all these associative neural pathways that just know how to just come up at a moment's notice. And the challenge is we have to decondition it. We have to interrupt it. This is really bringing this practice on the road, that every one of us plays out these patterns where we haven't really paused and deepened our attention to what's uncomfortable, our reactive patterns. So the first step is pausing. Again, there's no way around it. If we don't pause, we tumble into the same reactive, our tone of voice, the tension in our body, the kind of language, are the withdrawing, are the mental proliferation of judgment, we just roll right into it. So pausing, the sacred pause. And then I've mentioned many times, there's these two basic inquiries of what is happening inside me right now, and can I be with this? Okay. When we're in a relational dynamic or conflict, when we ask ourselves really in this moment, what is the intention going on here? When I'm criticizing, what's the intent? Well, maybe we'll find we're trying to fix somebody. We're trying to get them to be who we want them to be so we can feel better about ourselves or get what we want. But we start sensing what's there. And under that, under what's the intention, what's the unmet need in me? Whenever we're acting in a reactive way, in other words, whenever we're loving unwisely, there's an unmet need. If we can't see it and be with that place of vulnerability, we're going to keep on reacting. So maybe the unmet need is to be understood. Maybe the unmet need is to feel loved or to feel safe. So in this process of becoming more wise in our loving, we need to pause and sense the reactive intent, the unmet need, what's in there, and be with it. Because unless we've been with it, unless we have brought compassion to that place, we'll keep acting out of it. Then there's another, once we've been with it, we can begin to say, what's really my intention here? What do I really want? Because intention is layered. We spend most of our time, if we're not awake, with each other, operating out of the surface levels of intent that are driven by wanting and fearing, the agendas. If we can be with ourselves and pause, we drop to a much deeper kind of intention, which really wants to connect. A deeper intention that really wants to feel alive in the loving. But we can't get there unless we deal with the other levels. Does that make sense? Are you there with me? I just want to kind of check in, see if there's confusion. Give you an example, because this isn't about being passive. This is not about pausing and doing a lot of inner work and letting somebody else hurt us in some way or not dealing with what's going on with another person. This is learning to respond instead of react. Okay? One person told me this weekend about a teacher who had six-year-olds in his class. And they would space out and get distracted and not listen when he was asking them things. And his habit was that as that happened, he'd get impatient and his voice would raise. And he'd get kind of just that impatience and tension would come across. And then the kids would then act out. You know, then they'd get even some ways more rambunctious or more daydream or whatever it was. They just kind of cut off more distance. So he decided he had to interrupt his pattern. So he'd notice the kids in another world from him, or one kid, let's say. And his practice became to pause and to check in. And he sensed he was frustrated and that it went to a place of feeling inadequate. Like he was blowing it in some way. When a kid was spacing out and not paying attention to what was going on, he felt like he was failing. And then he'd just be with that feeling until he kind of had a kind presence with that. And then sense, well, what's really my intent? Rather than to control this kid so it behaves so I can feel good, what's really my intent? And his intent was to feel a sense of communication, connection. His intent was to be helpful, you know. So then when he got in touch with that and he could see the outcome of raising his voice was to create distance, He then started this practice where he would sit down right next to, let's say, a child who was kind of drifting or daydream or whatever, and just be really quiet, but just sit there looking at the child until finally they'd have eye contact. And then he'd say, "Oh, there you are." Do you understand that this power of breaking our habit? It's a pausing, and it's like we don't know what we're going to do next. It's not like he planned that. But when we pause and get in touch with what's really here, we also get in touch with the kind of a natural kind of creativity and intuition that can guide us in loving well. One woman described it this way, because sometimes the pause, other people help us to pause and break out of our trance-like patterns. A woman writes, "A few years ago, I was with a close woman friend in a grocery store in California. As we snaked along the aisles, we became aware of a mother with a small boy moving the opposite direction and meeting us head-on in each aisle. The woman barely noticed us because she was so furious at her little boy, who seemed intent on pulling items off the lower shelves. As the mother became more and more frustrated, she started to yell at the child, and several aisles later had progressed to shaking him up by the arm. At this point, my friend spoke up. A wonderful mother of three and founder of a progressive school, she had probably never once in her life treated any child so harshly. I expected my friend would give this woman a solid mother-to-mother talk about controlling herself and about the effect this behavior has on a child. Braced for the concentration, I felt a spike in my already elevated adrenaline. Instead, my friend said, 'What a beautiful little boy. How old is he?' The woman answered cautiously, 'He's 3. My friend went on to comment about how curious he seemed and how her own 3 children were just like him in the grocery store, pulling things off shelves, so interested in all the wonderful colors and packages. 'He seemed so bright and intelligent,' my friend said. The woman had the boy in her arms by now, and a shy smile came upon her face. Gently brushing his hair out of his eyes, she said, 'Yes, he's very smart and curious, but sometimes he wears me out.' My friend responded sympathetically, 'Yeah, they can do that. They're so full of energy.' As we walked away, I heard the mother speaking more kindly to the boy about getting home and cooking his dinner. 'We'll have your favorite, macaroni and cheese,' she told him. So these examples are adult-child examples. But really the pattern is in every relationship where we all get locked into ways of reacting, and underneath that feeling in some way like we need things to be different. And sometimes the reacting is mental and sometimes it's behavioral. But either way, it doesn't get us what we want. It's not wise loving. So thought maybe we just do just kind of a little practice on how we can wake up in the midst of that trance a little. And as you're doing now, just find a way of sitting that feels like you can bring the attention inward. And take some moments just again to feel the breath and relax with the breath. If in listening you left your body, which we often do, come on back. Just let go a little in the shoulders. And feel the hands. Soften there. Loosening in the belly, breathing in fully. And then letting yourself bring to mind a relationship in some ways calling your attention. I didn't want to make it so dramatic that there's sirens calling out for your attention, but how about a relationship where there's some conflict or difficulty or a place of difficulty where you want to be more awake? You don't want to go into trance and be reactive. And just in some way invite that person and sense the field of that relationship right here. Just if you'd like, in some way, just to honor, okay, so this is here and this is where I want to deepen my attention. Because just that aspiration to bring more wisdom to this loving is a deep part of energizing what's happening. Let yourself sense where you get caught. It's just some typical interaction where you find yourself getting reactive. It might be where you feel judged or where you get judgmental, where you feel hurt, where you feel misunderstood. Go right to that situation in your mind. Just sense when it's at its peak, when you're really reactive, when you're saying what you wish you weren't saying or withdrawing. Some way trying to control things. Just sense what's happening inside you. Just feel your body. Feel what's going on. Now, when you're caught in reactivity, what's the intent? What's the reactive intent? Trying to get them to pay attention to you, to do it your way, to like you, to understand you. For you, perhaps the language of what's the unmet need can be revealing. What is it you're really feeling? Where's the vulnerability? Is it that you don't feel understood or respected or cared about? Often we're reacting in the deepest way because we just don't feel loved. It's that mood of unlove that we're really running from. Just to acknowledge where the vulnerability is behind this reaction and see if you can bring a real kindness to that. For some it helps just to, as many of you know here, just to put your hand on your heart or touch your cheek lightly, just as you would a young child. And it's just an offering of presence. And you can even vary the pressure of the touch so that you really feel that you're offering a quality of tender presence. Just, I care about this. I care. This is human vulnerability. It's not my fault. Often the unmet need's a very familiar one. You might sense how familiar it feels in your life. So that you really offer it what it's asking for, which is a kind attention. Helps to breathe into the place where there might be a feeling of vulnerability. just sensing that you're caring about what's here. And as you really feel the presence deepening, to sense what it really is your intention, what's the deep intent, the heart's intent. What do you really want with this person? See if you can reconnect with what really matters. And as you do, as you sense what really matters, you might just intuit what would be the natural way to respond in this situation that would really help that unfold. You might have an image that comes to mind or some words. Or it might be just a not knowing, but that you're more available to find that out. Just sensing in your own body and heart how when you're willing to recognize the truth of suffering, how the reactivity just perpetuates distance, there's the possibility of loving from a wiser heart. So this is not a, an end point. This is kind of a way to begin to pay attention, to sense, well, what's the intention that's going on here? And what's the really deep intention? And how do we live from that? So that's the first characteristic, seeing clearly this pattern of how suffering gets perpetuated. The second characteristic is realizing impermanence. And in a way, a lot of our practice here, when we sit and we are opening and we're sensing, okay, thoughts are coming and going and the breath comes and goes and sensations. And in there's a kind of conceptual understanding of impermanence that we all have, you know, that the seasons change and people get older and so on. But as we practice in our bodies, that sense of impermanence gets very moment to moment. And the more we're awake to this changing flow, the more naturally our hands open. We don't cling on. It's like a student at IMS, the Insight Meditation Society, described how trying to hold on to changing experience is like holding on to a moving rope. You get rope burn, you know. Our Suzuki Roshi saying, you don't have to really let go or relinquish anything. It's more just this recognition that everything passes. So we bring that wisdom into our relationships. And one of the most powerful ways that we do that, that we bring this wisdom into our relationship, is by reflecting on mortality, on the fact that we're just here for a while. And there's some formal daily recollections in the Buddhist tradition that really have to do with sensing that this body and mind has the nature to age, to get sick, to die, that all that we love will also get sick and die. And it's not a morbid kind of reflection. It's like the shaman Don Juan described it, where he said, death is an advisor, that if we live with death on our left shoulder, all the pettiness vanishes. We get real with this life. We really arrive fully here. There's also more cherishing. If we are real with the truth of impermanence, we cherish what's here. I remember when my son was in the Waldorf school, One of his classmates was killed in a car accident, and it was just a huge, huge tragedy, and you could feel it just reverberating through the school. And I'll never forget that day when parents picked up their kids, how much the parents were holding their kids in such a dear, cherished way. It's like the sense of, we could lose what we have. We will lose what we have. Can we really show up right now and love it? What's right here? Thich Nhat Hanh, at his retreats, teaches... at the end of the retreat, he'll have people holding each other and a hug, a mindful hug. And he teaches them this way of reflecting, which I think is really incredible, where you take three full breaths, and with the first breath, you reflect, I'm going to die. And then with the second breath, you're going to die. And then with the third, and we have just these moments together. Imagine if we walked through our day and we really, not in a grim way, but in a just truth way, remembered that this is it, here we are. We all are going to die. Suzuki Roshi, I'm going to just read you something he wrote about practicing Zen. He said, we should practice Zazen like someone who's dying. For him, there's nothing to rely on. When you reach this kind of understanding, you will not be fooled by anything. So we could also say we should practice love like we're dying or like the other's dying. Because when we practice love like you're going to die and I'm going to die, we're not going to get so distracted. We're going to remember what matters. So this is the second characteristic, impermanence. And a story, it seemed tonight I'm having a lot of parent-child stories, but here we go again. Hurry up, Noam. Noam, let's go. Come on, Noam, I implored my four-year-old son. He does not get into his sneakers more quickly, if he does enough. How will I ever manage to do our errands and make it to the park in time for him to play before lunch? Brown eyes large and serious, Noam looks up at me. But I want to feed my horsey, he insists. Will you help me? We have to go, I want to say. We'll never get to the park on time. But before I say anything, I remember a story that really changed everything. When Susan was pregnant for the first time, she found out that she had cancer. She miraculously gave birth nonetheless to a healthy baby girl. But as the months passed, she and all those dear to her realized that she was not going to win the battle against cancer. Susan was dying. During that first year of her baby's life, the only year she would live to experience, Susan had a constant refrain, I have no time to rush. No time to rush. Here, Noam, I say now with a smile, showing him the toy carrot. Horses love carrots. Delighted, Noam holds the carrots out to his toy horse. Here, horsey, he says. His eyes are even bigger now and his face is radiant. He's so beautiful, I realize. And how long, after all, will he be asking me to help him feed his imaginary horse? So no time to rush. No time to rush through the moments we have with each other, with loved ones. No time to be unmechanical. No time to be in that trance where we forget what really matters. Okay? So that's the second characteristic. Remembering it's all changing. The third characteristic is the recognition of no self, which is really to say that when we sense it's all changing, and we really look at what are we? We're this changing flow of sensations and thoughts and feelings. And if we really look inside and say, well, who's here? Who's loving right now? We can't find a thing. We can't find a self. It's a mystery. In those moments when we're consolidated in our story of self, our love is tight. It's contracted. It's not free. In those moments where we can see through the veil and just rest in that vastness of awareness, that's the pure heart's release. So this is Stephen Levine writes this. He says, when we say love, we usually mean some emotion, some deep feeling for an object or person that is momentarily allows us to open to another. But in such emotional love, self-protection is never very far away. Awake love is not an emotion. It's a state of being. True love has no object. Many speak of their unconditional love for another. Unconditional love is the experience of being. There is no I and other, and anyone or anything it touches is experienced in love. You cannot unconditionally love another. You can only be unconditional love. It's not a dualistic emotion. It is a sense of openness with all that is. The experience of love arises when we surrender our separateness into the universal. It is a feeling of unity. You don't love another. You are another. There is no fear because there is no separation. So this is the third characteristic, that there is not a separate self entity in here. Certainly if we are thinking and telling ourselves stories, it seems that way. But in the realm of waking up and loving, there is a field of awareness that's loving. And that awareness loves its creation. It loves the waves that arise in it. And if our identity is contracted and hitched to just certain waves, loving certain other waves, it's going to be love, but contracted love, that has to defend and want something. If we remember the oceanness, the no self means that we're everything, then that love is unconditional and we're loving life. We're not loving an other. We're just in love with life. So the practice that helps to cultivate that sense of not taking it personally, but really opening to that vastness is the Tonglen practice in the Tibetan tradition, where we breathe in and let ourselves feel the feelings that are here, but breathe out and really offer them into the wholeness of awareness. And we'll be practicing that as closing. Just do a little time check. So really the inquiry that I feel like is the undercurrent for all of us on some level is, how do we love well? And every one of us gets caught in the conditioning where we are in that trance of reactivity. So the invitation is, more and more, rather than feeling like something's wrong with me for being in that, that those are the places where we can wake up our hearts. The very places where we get conflictual and narrow, we can start pausing. And we can have the courage to say, okay, so what's the reactive intent? What's going to be the outcome of just playing it out like this? And then just, what's the real vulnerability here? Can we be with that? Can we sense the deepest intention? These are all the different reflections that unfold this. There are infinite ways then that we express our love. Once we're at home with what really matters, there are infinite ways. One woman described in a very sweet kind of story. She said, doctor said that my 88-year-old mother-in-law was losing her memory rapidly and told me to check by asking her routine questions every day. So, Mammy, how many kids do you have? And every time, after a lot of stalling, she would tick off the names of at least 3 of her 5 children. After the third day, she asked me a question. Do you eat almonds? No, why? She touched my hand gently and lovingly. I think you should. It'll improve your memory. So there really is this kind of a spontaneous love that comes when we're at home, when we're not wanting something, we're not defending. So we'll do a final closing meditation on this. Relaxing, relaxed attention right here. And again, just to let yourself bring to mind someone that you want to feel an awakeness in your loving with. And as you bring that person to mind, you might just sense if there's kind of an intuition of what stops you from having kind of a free, loving feeling. And just sense into yourself if there's some fear or mistrust, some concern that it's not mutual or you're not understood, something that makes you feel unsafe. So just in a simple way, just sensing the vulnerability that might be here without any judgment. Maybe the vulnerability is feeling that you are not enough, that you can't really offer what you should. But just taking the practice you've done tonight and just bringing a presence to wherever there's a sense of vulnerability or doubt or fear or judgment, and just breathing with it. And if it helps, as we've done earlier, just to place your hand at your heart and just feel right here a very kind presence with wherever there is a sense of vulnerability. You just come home to presence. But the vulnerability is like currents in the sea. And then you're here. You're big. You're present. To feel really, what's my intention? What's the deepest intention here with this person? As a whispered prayer, just sense, what is it you really want? And you might imagine that hug that I described, that you're with this person and there's that sense of reflecting, okay, so I'm going to die and you're going to die. And we have these moments in this life together. So that you can just feel in a simple way the cherishing, the caring. And to let yourself feel that viscerally, just to sense the goodness of this being, what you appreciate, and just to feel your heart in a very immediate way, just the caring that's there. And you might, as a way of really deepening presence, sense who is caring right now. And who am I caring for? Is there really someone in here caring? Or can you just let go into the sense of this field of loving? No self, no other. That when we let go of ideas, there's just that warmth and openness. that you're joined as this ocean of awareness, cherishing the particulars but knowing your identity as that vastness, loving awareness. We each came to this earth to do one thing. And even if we succeed at 100 other tasks, if this one thing is neglected, our life will be wasted. And if this one thing is fulfilled, then whatever else happens, our life will be fulfilled. Some languages call this one thing love. And when love is present, the whole world turns into the temple. Just feeling that space or field of loving that really unconditionally loves life, that holds those that are here in this room in your heart, that holds all beings everywhere in your heart. May our practices tonight, our reflections, our prayers really be of benefit to all beings. May the aliveness of love ripple out and touch all beings, that all may discover their belonging to love, to awareness, that all may be free. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.